Shrink Wrap Radio number 331, A Jungian Approach to Addiction with Dr. David Shane.
It's Shrink Wrap Radio. All the psychology you need to know, and just enough to make it dangerous. It's all in your head. And now here's your host, Dr. Dave.
My guest today is Jungian analyst and author David Shane, and we'll be discussing his work in addictions counseling, as well as his book on the connection between Jung and Alcoholics Anonymous. Jungian analyst David Shane has over 30 years' experience as an addictions counselor. He's also a senior analyst in the Interregional Society of Jungian Analysts, and the co-founder of the Jung Society of Baton Rouge. He's a lecturer, writer of several internationally published books, and a Louisiana poet. His books include Divine Tempest, The Hurricane as a Psychic Phenomenon, and his most recent, The War of Gods in Addiction, C.G. Jung, Alcoholics Anonymous, and Archetypal Evil. Now, here's the interview. David Shane, welcome to Shrink Wrap Radio.
Thank you.
Well, it's a pleasure to meet you and have you on the show. And I believe you're in Louisiana. Do I have that right?
That's right. I sure am.
Well, I interviewed another Louisiana Jungian that you might know. Does the name Richard Chasseret ring a bell?
Yeah, Richard's in Lafayette.
Yeah, I interviewed him about the tragedy of the BP oil spill in the Gulf, which he was very concerned about at the time that we spoke. It was not too long after that. And I see things on TV, you know, that are ads basically by BP saying, oh, we've cleaned up the Gulf and fish are there and people are swimming and so on. I'm just curious, since you're there, what's your take on the situation as it stands now?
Well, they do seem to have cleaned up most of what they have spilled. I think the question is the long-term damage to the fish and the shellfish in the Gulf, in terms of what effects the oil will have on the future crops of those things.
Sure.
Right now, it looks like it looks okay, but you know, in the recent storm down here, the water and waves kicked up the sand and it unearthed more of the tar balls that were from the storm.
Sorry to hear
still
that.
Out. The final's still out on all of that, you know.
Right.
But there has been improvement. I mean, I eat seafood all the time, and I wouldn't if I thought it was dangerous. And it is. It's pretty good, at least the stuff that we're getting, you know.
Okay, well, that's good news. Now,
sure.
You're both a Jungian analyst, and you've also been an addictions counselor with a background in social work. Which came first, your involvement in addictions counseling or becoming a Jungian analyst?
I was a clinical social worker first, and then the addictions counseling, and then I got my certification as a Jungian analyst.
Well, tell us a story of how you came to be a Jungian analyst. Generally, everybody's got kind of an interesting pathway about sort of, you know, how did you get the call?
Well, I was in graduate school, and my supervisor, Elaine Molchanov, was in training to be an analyst, and I didn't know anything about Jungian psychology. This is back in the 70s. But for some reason, I started recording all the dreams from my past that I could remember, and then I brought them to Elaine, and we started working on the dreams, and I realized at that point that I wanted to be a Jungian analyst, but it was a long time until I could be in the position to be able to do that. pretty much what I had done was, had gone through all the normal theories at schools, Gestalt and rational emotive and all that kind of stuff, and mm-hmm. family systems and all. And they were all good. They all had value, but when I hit Jungian psychology, it was like, I'm never going to get to the end of this,
was right.
what I realized. And so it was sort of like I was in the deep water that I wanted to be in, and I could be in pretty much forever,
Yes.
So that's kind of my story in terms of the Jungian analyst thing. And I had to go to Texas, region or seminar through the Interregional Society. They didn't have one in Louisiana at the time. And I had to go there to get my training. So I got a lot of frequent flyer coupons with Southwest Airlines. And then eventually when I became an analyst, I was one of the founding members of the New Orleans Jungian Seminar, which trains people to be Jungian analysts, too.
Uh-huh. Okay. So, yeah, I didn't know about that group. And how is it you came to be interested in the field of addictions?
Well, that's an interesting story. Kind of the last thing that I wanted to do was work in addictions. I basically was trying to get out of the state hospital system, and I was looking a bunch of different places, and then I got a fortune cookie that said opportunity lies not where it should be but where it is, which got me. So I got this fortune cookie, and I started thinking differently, like, okay, well, where is opportunity that I've been excluding? So right down the road was an addictions chemical dependency unit, and I had never really been interested in that. And I thought, well, maybe I ought to look at that. I ought to consider that. It's not where my opportunity should be, but maybe it is. So I went over there and interviewed, and they had a great treatment program, with lots of group and individual therapy and very, very innovative psychodrama and all kinds of things. So I learned basically a lot about directly addictions from that. But I also had a natural interest in addictions because three of my brothers are recovering alcoholics. And my mother-in-law is, and my deceased stepmother-in-law was an alcoholic too, and they all recovered through AA and the 12 steps, and so I was very grateful to the 12 steps, for basically saving their lives, because they were all going down the tubes in one way or another. And And I don't know, regular counseling and everything else wasn't really helpful. So that got me curious and thinking about what is it about AA that seems to be effective in terms of addiction and alcoholism that other stuff isn't. And
yeah.
So that got me going on my quest in terms of writing the book.
Yes.
What's the phenomena,
Now let me just back you up a little bit.
Sure.
Did you get into the addiction work before or after you became a Jungian analyst?
I got into the addiction work before. I had to be in a position to have the money and the time. So I had to have my private practice established. So I
sure.
did the addiction stuff, and then transitioned into private practice. And then when I did that, I was able to start my analysis. So it was a long road. It was probably 10 years after I knew I wanted to be an analyst before I had an opportunity.
Sure. I'm not surprised to hear that. I know it is a long road. Now, you mentioned your book, and we're going to be talking about that quite a bit. You titled your book "The War of the Gods in Addiction." What are you getting at with that idea of the war of the gods?
Well, what I'm getting at is that there's an archetypal level to addiction that's pretty much not been looked at before. It's been viewed in terms of, you know, ego and dynamics and impulse control and obsession, obsessive compulsive, that kind of thing. But what I'm positing is that there's an element in every true addiction that has the ability to kill you, okay? And that it's impersonal, and the counter to that, or the neutralizing factor to that, seems to be like the higher power in AA. Now, whether you believe in the higher power or not, basically, that there are forces that are beyond the individual involved in addiction and in its cure. And so there's literally a war going on the archetypal level in terms of these factors. So that's what I was alluding to with the war of the gods, that these powers are way beyond the human, and they, you know, both destructive and healing, positive, both directions. You know?
Okay, now maybe you've just answered what was going to be my next question, that you say that you hope to break new ground in this book, and I wanted to say how so. So did you answer that question, or do you have a little bit more to say about what the new ground might be?
Yeah, I would say that what I posit is what I call archetypal shadow, archetypal evil, archetypal evil. The same, it's the same thing. It's different words for the same phenomena. I should say that, you know, my particular vantage point is I'm a phenomenologist first before anything, and that is that what I care about is understanding the phenomena. Mm-hmm. And I wanted to understand the phenomena of addiction, and then I wanted to understand the phenomena of the healing in addiction. And so I don't really care, in a sense, I don't care about theories or schools or that everything has to fit together and all that kind of stuff. I basically, to me, different theories have value to the extent that they accurately reflect the phenomenon. And so you have different theories that may reflect different aspects of a phenomenon.
Sure.
So I don't get into defending Jungian psychology or any other view of addiction per se. I'm just looking for the most accurate representation of the image of what's going on in the dynamics of addiction.
Okay. Okay, that's kind of helps to set the groundwork for our discussion. And probably before we go any further, I should ask you, how do you define addiction?
I define addiction probably different than anybody else that I know of. To be a true addiction, and I make a distinction between things in our society that we describe as addiction that are, you know, eating too much chocolate, and, you know, you talk about positive addictions, and it's almost like if everything's an addiction, then nothing's an addiction. Okay.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
In terms of clinically, diagnostically, I mean, I don't have exclusive rights to the terminology, but when we use the term addiction in the diagnostic statistical manual, we're talking about dependency, and, you know, what they refer as dependency, as opposed to abuse, which is like messing with it, but not, you're not hooked, you know. With addiction, the two things are that, first of all, whatever the addictive behavior is, that whether it's drugs, alcohol, sex, food, gambling, you name it, it has to have the potential to kill you, to take over everything in a person's life. I mean, ultimately, there's your health, your family, your job, your whole sense of vitality gets swallowed up or put on the altar of the addiction. Ultimately, I mean, I know some people, I should say, who are dead because they could not maintain of the battle against the addiction, and they succumb, you know?
Yeah. In fact, in the book, you make a pretty strong statement. You say addiction is a death sentence, and that seems like pretty strong language. Is that always the case? I know I've interviewed some people who have suggested, you know, that there are non-AA ways to go, and or that even social drinking is possible for
right.
some
well,
people.
Well, and
who've
what I would say
addicts.
Is that we confuse the diagnostic material, because there are a lot of, you know, people can drink too much, they can drink too often, they can, you know, they can abuse drugs and alcohol. It doesn't make them addicted. Addiction is where you can't control that addictive behavior. It takes over control of you and the ego.
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, people who say that, you know, there are social drinkers and people can be taught to drink and, you know, whatever, it's really important that you start out with an accurate assessment, a definition, a diagnosis of whether you've got an addicted person or a person who is abusing whatever they're doing, okay?
Okay.
Because if they're abusing it, then the normal course of ego strengthening and education and information, you know, will do the trick for you, okay? Like in normal therapies and stuff. In normal kinds of mental illness, et cetera. If it's an addiction, you've got to, that doesn't work, you see? And so what I'm basically saying is that it has to take over complete control of the person. And are you getting a static coming through?
Yeah, I'm hearing a lot of static.
Is that better?
I think it is.
So going back to what we were saying, the two elements are that the addiction has to become the number one priority in the psyche and take over everything else, okay?
Okay.
And then it has to have the capacity to kill you, in my opinion. And I have a basis for that, which is not just, you know, that I invented that idea. And that comes from, basically I went back to the Bill W., the co-founder of AA, and Carl Jung's correspondence, where Jung talks about his thoughts on addiction. And he basically alludes to the fact that there is, he doesn't call it archetypal evil, archetypal shadow, but he alludes to this phenomena that will destroy you, that will kill you, and that the only way is basically to turn to the archetypal, you know, grace or higher power and fellowship and all the things that AA has. And so it's sort of, I'm extrapolating material from the letters between Bill W. and Carl Jung in terms of the development of my theory. And I think if Jung were here, he would vote for it. He would say, yes, you're on target. You know?
Yeah, I think you're right about that.
Well, I wanted to say what you brought up before, that, you know, people say, are you saying that AA is the only way? No, I'm not saying that AA is the only way or that the 12 steps per se are the only way. But what I am saying is that if you have a true addiction and you don't have a program that somehow operates on the basic principles of the 12 steps in some way, in terms of neutralizing the archetypal shadow, archetypal evil, and the person taking responsibility for their behavior through, like, the rest of the steps, 4 through 12 or 4 through 10, then it's not going to work, you know? I had a client who, a therapist who was teaching a smoking cessation class, and basically he was trying to help people to stop, and some people stopped initially, and then they returned to it, and some people, of course, stopped and stopped forever. And I said to him, look, you know, if the smoking in with these people is truly an addiction, then all the education in the world is not going to make the difference. You have to neutralize the archetypal shadow, archetypal evil aspect if it's a true addiction. And so therefore, those people aren't going to be able to stop smoking and hold it, you know? And it made sense to him that that's kind of what he was observing, you know, in the people. And, yeah. I think it's really important to know whether we're dealing with an addiction or abuse, because we're using totally different strategies initially, and it wouldn't make that much difference, except that people are literally dying when they're told that they can drink again and they can be taught to drink if they are addicted. Okay.
Yeah.
And the guy out in California, I don't remember his name, but he has this commercial on television all the time, the Addiction Counseling Institute or something, and he guarantees people that he can teach them to drink and heal it without using the 12 steps and AA and all that kind of stuff. And I'm thinking, you know, people want to hear that. The addiction wants to hear that, but it ultimately, you know, he's not just another charlatan out there, which there are a lot of, but he's responsible for people's deaths, and he needs to realize that, you know, because he's selling essentially snake oil to people who are desperate, you know, who are looking for things.
Yeah, sure. Now, your distinction between abuse and addiction is an interesting one. It's not one that I've heard before. It does make sense to me the way you describe it. And I definitely want to get more into that correspondence between Jung and Bill W. But before we do, say something about what the view of alcoholism and treatment was before the advent of AA.
Well, basically, before the story began, it was considered a degenerative, hopeless disease. If you were a true hardcore alcoholic, it was considered a death sentence. And you know, they tried therapy and psychoanalysis and rescuers and aversion treatments and everything, and nothing worked before AA. And then when AA came along, suddenly, according to to observations, that maybe a third of the people were recovering and getting sober and staying sober. And so, you know, when people argue, well, that's not such a great statistic, and I say, well, you know, when the success is zero and you start getting 33%, that's pretty good, you know. And of course, there are no official statistics kept in AA because it's an anonymous voluntary program, but the observations are that there's a third who get sober, who get the program and stay sober, and there's about a third who go back and forth, and then there's a third that basically isn't helped for lots of different reasons, that they can't do what needs to be done. But still, a third from nothing is quite an accomplishment. And in we can talk about more, so before AA, and actually, I don't know whether you want to get into this at the moment, but you know, Roland H. Went and saw Carl Jung in the 1930s, I think it was, and he did analysis and he got sober and he came back to Jung and he relapsed, as most alcoholics do, and he thought he'd get a recharge with Jung, or a second course of treatment. And Jung basically said, "I'm sorry, Roland, but I don't have anything else to offer you, and this is a pretty hopeless situation, in my opinion, unless you have a spiritual conversion that addresses this." Now, AA didn't exist, and the whole idea of a spiritual conversion in terms of alcoholism and addiction wasn't out there, you know, where people know it like it is today. So Roland went to the Oxford movement, which was a program that was helping alcoholic addicted individuals, and they were having some success, but they weren't having complete success because they didn't know what to do with alcoholics who relapsed. And so what they were doing was they were kicking them out of the program. Mm-hmm. So AA learned from the Oxford movement's position. So then, long story short, Roland got sober through the Oxford movement, and then he was a friend of Bill W.'s, and he helped Bill W. get sober. And so Bill W. realized that it was Jung's admission, acknowledgement of his powerlessness and Roland's powerlessness over the alcohol that became really the first steps of AA, and then that you were willing to turn to a higher power, and then did so, you know, took the action.
Yeah, there are a couple of things I want to respond to in what you've said. First of all, I'm struck by Jung's humility that he was able to say to Roland, you know, I'm not going to be able to help you. My approach to analysis isn't going to be able to help you. And, you know, and then he goes on to the second. So that's, you know, that's, I think, fairly humble of him.
You know, as I say in the book, he's probably the greatest psychoanalyst in the world, and he's saying, I can't do it, you know.
Yeah.
And you know, the humility that was involved in that. I mean, I don't know if you know many therapists, but there are not many therapists who will admit that they can't help and they can't do anything, you know.
Yeah, right.
It's always the patient's resistance or fault or, you know, whatever. They often are resistant to the idea that they don't have the things in the toolbox to help this person, you know. Jung did. He was aware that he had done all he could, when Bill W. wrote the letter of appreciation to Jung in terms of the founding, unknowing founding of AA, Jung didn't know what had ultimately happened to Roland, you know, and so he was happy to get that information.
Yeah, now I was surprised to read in your book about this exchange of letters, which, by the way, I think was in 1961, you said?
Yeah, in 61, right.
Yeah, so, and, you know, I've been sort of a fellow traveler of Jungian psychology for about 40 years, not an analyst, but, and I'd never heard of this connection between Jung and Alcoholics Anonymous. Am I unusual in that regard?
Well, you know, the letters have been out there for a long time, and they're acknowledged periodically. There have been a number of Jan Bauer wrote a book on alcoholism in women, and she quoted those letters, and you know, the Grapevine had those letters through AA, and you can find them, but nobody really looked closely at what was being said, you know. Well, yeah. Not close enough, in my opinion. It's mm-hmm. it's like it needed to be taken apart and analyzed. You know what Bill W. said and what Jung said.
Well, let me say that another thing that struck me was his suggestion that a religious conversion of some sort was needed, and that was of particular interest to me. You mentioned smoking cessation, and I've been very involved with hypnosis over the years, and I tried to help people quit smoking with hypnosis, and I found I got spotty results, you know, despite right. the extreme claims that are made by many. And then later I was influenced by, well, I guess I independently, I had this notion, partly because I grew up in a fundamentalist Christian environment with all sorts of miraculous healings and so on, and, uh-huh. and my grandfather actually, I guess, had been an alcoholic and so on, and then he was converted. And so I had this notion that some kind of a conversion experience could perhaps get a person over an addiction. And so I got the idea of doing, and I'd read some stuff about sensory deprivation that seemed very promising. And so I actually tried to offer a commercial service for just, it never really got off the ground, but where I wanted to do something like sensory deprivation and have people, you know, and have some positive suggestions coming in and so on. I actually did an N of one with a friend who was heavily addicted to smoking and put him into a totally soundproof, dark, anechoic, some kind of special chamber that the audiology department had. And he went in there for 24 hours and played various suggestions and music and heartbeats and all kinds of things. When he came out of that thing 24 hours later, he looked like a newborn baby, totally transformed. And in fact, he did quit smoking. He never smoked again. So that's an N of
one.
Yeah, N of one. So I'm totally convinced that that a religious conversion, that some kind of dramatic altered state of consciousness kind of experience can be critical. And in that regard, you talked a bit about the influence of William James and his book on AA. Maybe just say a word about that.
Well, William James, both Bill W. and Jung were familiar with William James. William James studied varieties of religious experience, and what he saw was that all true religious experiences were involved the collapse of the ego. That as long as the ego kept trying to run things and call the shots, you weren't going to have the transformation that you needed. So the first step is, you know, to admit that you're powerless over alcohol, is for the ego to say, I'm not in charge anymore. That's the hardest thing for a human being to do, is to say, this isn't something that I can control. We constantly think we can control it. And then in that collapse of the ego, the infected ego, is taken out of commission and replaced by, the fellowship of AA and the person working the steps and, you know, having a sponsor, et cetera. And then the recovery begins. But the first thing that's involved in addiction is this collapse of the ego, that it's like putting the infected ego out of commission for a while until the person is able to recover their normal ego functions in looking at things realistically, you know, because that infected ego is going to continually find a way to lead the person back to their addiction, because it's under the influence of the addiction, which is going to work all kinds of ways to get the person back. You know, things are going too good, things are going too bad, somebody says something, you know, you get angry and you know, some people it's like, The one thing that could help them in terms of AA, they reject it because they don't like the people I don't know, you know, there's lots.
Yeah, there are always these reasons that rationalizations that come
right
up.
Right, but the thing that's interesting is that the very thing that could help you is what you reject out of hand, you know.
Yeah.
And if I was diabolical, and I think an addiction is, in a psychological sense, that's exactly the way that I would work it, you know?
Yeah.
I would
right.
keep you away from what can help you, you know? I've had people, I've worked, you know, continued to work with addicted folks somewhat, and later on in recovery, and I can literally tell the difference when they're getting ready to start drinking or using again, because their whole attitude when they walk through the room and the way they look physically is changed. They're no longer open and receptive and whatever. They're belligerent and they're, you know, they've got all the answers and everything I'm saying is BS, you know.
Yeah.
And it's like night and day, you know, between when they're invested in recovery, and when they're beginning to slip back under the influence of the addiction.
Yeah. Well, take us through it somewhat systematically here, the commonalities between Jungian psychology and AA, your view of the psychodynamics of addiction, how the 12 steps relate to the process of individuation, that whole ball of wax, if you can kind of move us through it.
Basically, what I'm saying is that you've asked a big question.
I know. I've asked you the whole book.
What I'm basically saying is that the 12 steps are the alcoholic AA's discernment of the individuation process, the Jungian process, but it's through them. So when they refer to the higher power, we can easily translate that into the self in the Jungian sense, you know?
Yes.
When they go into the steps about taking responsibility for hurting other people and you're doing your inventory and all of that in AA, that's essentially a lot. That's the same work that we have in analysis in terms of the person dealing with their shadow, and so there's a lot of the elements that are the same. It's just, again, if we remember that we're more concerned about phenomena than labeling, it's very similar or the same phenomena. You know.
Mm-hmm.
The thing that I don't see in AA that Jungian psychology has in its process is I don't see an overt appreciation of the anima animus, you know, the contrasexual aspects in the AA program. But I don't know, maybe it's in there somewhere, and maybe it's not necessary because they're concerned about, you know, people getting sober. But otherwise, it's pretty much the same thing in terms of the individuation process.
What about the social support part? That's so important in AA, is that it's a group, it's a community. I don't know if that's...
Yeah, it's exactly.
Yeah.
You know, Jung breaks it down from his experience in terms of people recovering through an act of grace, through the fellowship of other human beings, or through the work of working the program, the steps, et cetera. And AA, even though a lot of the work is done between the analyst and the analyst-on, one of the things that Jung says is that you don't individuate on Mount Everest, you know, alone. You individuate in the matrix of your life and community and relationships. And then he says, like AA, that ultimately we do the analysis and individuation work, not for ourselves, not so that we can become enlightened human beings, but we do it because ultimately our responsibility into the world and to others is expanded, and we will be able to contribute. So there's very much a community aspect. It's more direct in AA, but it's definitely there in Jungian psychology too, you know?
Yes.
It's just a matter of, I think that it's a matter of emphasis is different sometimes, but it's there, you know?
You know, going back to your title about the gods, in Jungian psychology, we talk about the personal shadow and the archetypal shadow. Maybe you can say a bit about that and how it relates to what you're talking about here.
What I'm talking about, the personal shadow is basically influenceable, educable, and redeemable by working on it, which is, you know, what Jungian psychology encourages. But the archetypal shadow is impervious to being integrated, educated, transformed. It's basically beyond that. It can't be healed. I'm not just the one who says that, but you can look in terms of von Franz and Jung and you know, a number of other people. And when I read that, I thought, you know what? There's an aspect in addiction, in alcoholism, that is not redeemable. You know, by the stop, purse, stop it, stop. That's not redeemable by.
It's funny, we're talking about the shadow and the dog starting to growl.
Yeah, dog's growling. Somebody's outside walking by, and he goes crazy. You know, he's so territorial. I lose my train of thought.
We were talking about the archetypal shadow.
Yeah, and the archetypal shadow requires something different. Requires an archetypal intervention. That's what I call it. Which is the higher power, which is, it's like the only thing that will cancel out or neutralize the archetypal shadow, archetypal evil, is something of equal power on the other side. So the big guns are archetypal good and healing and transformation is the only thing that can neutralize the archetypal evil, archetypal shadow. And so that's why those first three steps in AA are so essential in terms of recovery. Because if you don't do that and you have a true addiction, then you continue with a person who has an infected ego that ultimately is going to bring them back to the addiction, you know. So the archetypal, it's kind of like, you know, nuclear radiation or something. You can't mess with it. You can't. It's not like most things in Jungian psychology. We talk about befriending and integrating and whatever. This is something really different. And I've upset some people by saying this, but I'm not inventing these things. They existed in discussion before me, but they weren't well known by other people. Mm-hmm. It's for them to suddenly encounter the idea that there's something in the psyche or in the psychic system that can't be integrated or impacted or transformed in a normal way is something very, very strange to people, you know. And then when you add to that, well, if you got it and you're infected by it, it can kill you. You know, that's pretty hard to accept.
I've heard the idea that substance addicts, like alcoholics, are in fact reaching for some kind of spiritual transcendence, that there's some kind of a misguided spiritual impulse or something. What's your thoughts on that?
Well, my thoughts are the same as Jung's, that he says that alcohol, the alcoholic is thirsting for the ultimate spirit, but it winds up accepting an inferior spirit, you know. But that behind the impulse is a desire for wholeness and healing that's misguided. And so that's very much part of it. And I think that's part of what... that's part of why the addiction is so incredibly dangerous, is because it takes that normal, natural desire and it distorts it and twists it into something that ultimately will destroy you, you know? And yet it's a good desire, you know? Bill W., when he had his first drink, thought he had almost gone to heaven, you know? maybe that's an exaggeration, but it was a totally numinous experience for him. And people have that with different behaviors in terms of addiction. And, so that becomes a, yeah.
Who would you say your book is intended for?
I would say that it's intended for the non-believer in this sense that, AA people who hear my presentations and read my book, I just get an amen from them, you know. In fact, one of the highest compliments I get sometimes is because I'm not a recovering alcoholic myself, but, you know, I've been very close to it. And what they say to me is, you know, David, we don't know how you know what you know, but you know, okay?
And so that is a high compliment. Yes.
That is coming from people who are in the club. That is very, very gratifying.
Yeah.
And so what it means to me is that my book holds water. That it's not leaking out. It's not a misrepresentation of things. You know.
Do you think that people who, in fact, are addicted would benefit from this book?
Yes. I've had other people who are addicted that it adds to their information and understanding of what they're up against, and it has made a difference. And then I wanted to you know, not only the non-believers, but particularly therapists, because I find that therapists have their own distorted prejudices and views about alcoholism and addiction and AA that the common person does. And I wanted to educate them about what's really going on. And they could understand, I'm hoping, the psychodynamic language that I present, even if they can't buy the some people consider the brainwashing of AA, you know?
Yes.
Which I don't think it is brainwashing, but that's their view, you know, that you know, you replace your drinking with going to meetings and saying the formulas and, you know, the sayings and things, and that just totally misses the point, you know? It's for non-believers, it's for the for therapists, it's for addicted individuals, and it's for Jungian folk, because there's been very little in Jungian literature about this, and a number of people have told me that it's been incredibly helpful to them in their work with Jungian analysts with alcoholic addicted individuals. You know, it's kind of like it gives them a roadmap to be able to operate with, you know.
Yes. Well, you know, that's probably go ahead and finish your thought.
Well, just that way, you know, and then the common person who's just fascinated and interested in archetypal shadow, archetypal evil, and what's this guy got to say about that, you know?
Yeah.
That's my audience, you know.
Yeah.
So it's pretty broad, and it's been pretty well received. I mean, I've gotten some hostility. I don't know if it's rationalization or what, but the hostility has come, I think, due to ignorance, you know, to the people who weren't understanding what I was saying, or that what I was saying was so challenging to them that they had to reject it. You know, it didn't fit their preconceived notions of Jungian psychology or alcoholism or those things, you know.
Well, I think this is probably a good place to wrap it up. I think we've pretty much covered the major bases here, and people will want to follow up with the book. Is there anything we've left out that you want to say before we wrap it up here?
The force be with you.
Okay.
David, and the higher power, and the higher power too, you know?
Yeah, right.
I just think that it's so essential that people would connect with an authentic, and I don't really care what it is or looks like, as long as it's an authentic spiritual connection. I think we're all in danger without it, you know,
mm-hmm.
As Jung talks about in his letter. So, you know, I would encourage the people out there who hear this and maybe read my book to find their way to a spirituality that works for them, you know, that could counteract the forces of evil in the universe, you know.
Okay, well, that's a good place to wrap it. David Shane, it's great to speak with you, and thanks for being my guest today on Shrink Wrap Radio.
You're very much welcome. Thank you, David.
Were you surprised to learn that Alcoholics Anonymous was inspired by both Jung and in part by William James and his varieties of religious experience? Well, as you heard me admit my ignorance publicly, I was. As Dr. Shane suggested, this book should have very broad appeal, whether you are a therapist, someone struggling with addiction, the relative or friend of someone wrestling with addiction, or someone interested in the origins of Alcoholics Anonymous, or just generally interested in Jungian thought. My strategic partners have some special offers for you in connection with this interview. First of all, if you use my discount code of Dr. Dave, that's D-R-D-A-V-E, on Jung platform, you can get 25% off the regular $19.75 price of an hour and a half video DVD of a lecture that Dr. Shane gave, or 25% off on the $12.75 for the audio lecture that Dr. Shane gave on the same topic. Then, as if that's not enough, you can participate in an online book discussion about the book on Depth Psychology Alliance website. Dr. Shane will be dropping in on the bulletin board type discussion from time to time and will be available every week on a teleseminar with the readers and listeners. You'll find links for these two opportunities on the Shrink Wrap Radio website and in my show notes.
Let us all come together to see what we can find. Shrink Wrap Radio is here to remind you it's all in your mind. Let us all remember what you seek is what you find. Dr. Dave is here to remind you it's all in your mind. Exploring our spirit and our psyche, we are learning to unwind. Shrink Wrap Radio is here to remind you it's all in your mind.
It's been a long time since I've played that one, and there might even be new listeners out there who haven't heard it. So I wanted to dust it off, even though it's not Christmas music. Next week is Christmas, and I'm giving myself the gift of taking the week off. My son Matthew will be coming home from Manhattan to celebrate Christmas with the rest of the family, and my wife and I are expecting our fourth grandchild any day now. Please know that I'm wishing you and yours a wonderful holiday season. Despite so much that is disturbing in the world, we all still have much to be thankful for, and I hope you'll hold that thought through this holiday season. As my holiday fundraising appeal, let me repeat what I said in our last episode. Shrink Wrap Radio brings you amazing interviews with incredible guests every week, if I do say so myself. And I put in 10 or more hours on each episode. You have free access to now 331 interviews, 7 years of work, and this is supported by listener donations from about 20 to 30 people each month. I'm very grateful for all those donations, but 20 to 30 people, when some of the episodes are downloaded by more than 5,000 of you? If all those people committed to only $5 a month, I'd be getting a living wage out of this. So please make a stocking stuffer donation of $5 a month or more to Shrink Wrap Radio. Now, $5 a month, that's about one Starbucks latte a month for all the caffeinated foamy goodness you get here at Shrink Wrap Radio. Such a deal. I'm pleased to announce a new 8-unit CE course through the Zur Institute. As you know, I've been on a real neuroscience kick lately, and this 8-unit course is part of my body-slash-mind-slash-spirit course sequence. This one is titled Brain:Insights from Neuroscience, and this course is based on the following interviews, 11 interviews actually, The Secret Lives of the Brain with David Eagleman, The Polyvagal Theory with Dr. Stephen Porges, Psychopathology in the Brain with Dr. Daniel Amen, Pre- and Perinatal Psychology with Dr. William Emerson, MindSight with Dr. Daniel Siegel, The Meditating Brain with Dr. Richard Davidson, The Neuroscience of Meditation with Dr. Sarah Lazar, The Effects of Meditation and CBT on the Brain with Dr. Philippe Golden, Nirvana and the Brain with Dr. Jill Bolte Taylor, Visual Thinking and Autism with Dr. Temple Grandin, and finally, Creativity in the Brain with Harvard's Dr. Shelley Carson. So, to get more information or to sign up, just go to the store tab on our site for the link to the fully accredited Zur Institute site. If you go to the Shrink Wrap Radio site, you'll notice a couple of new links in the right-hand sidebar, which we hope you'll patronize. One is to Jungian Robert Bosnack's Santa Barbara Healing Sanctuary, and the other is to Bruce Ecker's landmark book, Unlocking the Emotional Brain. Speaking of Robert Bosnack, we have a new transcript on the site thanks to Jim Sidney. It's number 328, The Red Book and Cycles of Change with Jungian analyst Robert Bosnack. Thanks, Gemma. Have I mentioned lately that most of our shows have typed transcripts that you can download for free? Thanks to the volunteers who've made that happen. It provides incredible value, I think. Those transcripts are also extremely helpful to me when I'm putting together the CE courses and our newsletter, and any time that I need to quickly review what was covered in a given interview. There's so much good info in these interviews, and I don't always remember it all. A quick refresher can be very useful, and I suspect that may be true for many of you as well. By the way, there are still a number of transcripts I'm waiting for. So if you volunteered to do one, please get that transcript to me, or at least send me a status update.
Hi, this is Dr. John Arden, psychologist, workshop leader, author, and you're on the couch with Dr. Dave.
Thank you, Dr. John Arden, who will be my next guest. More about that in a bit. First, let's hear some recent feedback from our listener community. Here's one from Thomas, who writes in reply to my thanks for his donation. Dear Dr. Dave, your podcasts and commentaries have been an inspiration for me for the past several months. The energy and enthusiasm that I hear you express in running and perfecting your labor of love has given me a needed boost as I'm getting ready to launch my new business. I wonder what that business might be. He goes on to say, I particularly enjoyed your podcast that made me aware of post-traumatic growth, and hope you can find an opportunity to interview more guests knowledgeable in that field. As a journalist, I'm fascinated by guilt versus shame versus fear-based societies and basic lack of understanding when these societies come into conflict. Have you done a show touching onto this in the past? With gratitude, that's from Thomas, or maybe it's Tomas. Those are great suggestions. I thank you so much for that feedback. It's a great idea for me to seek out more on post-traumatic growth. I think that's a very good suggestion, good topic. And no, I don't think I have done anything on guilt versus shame versus fear-based societies. So I'll keep my eye out for a really good guest along those lines. Moving along, similarly, Margaret in Vienna also wrote in reply to my thanks for her donation, saying, "Dear David, thanks for your prompt reply. I very much appreciate your work and am grateful for your podcasts. Not only are they educational and provide insightful information, but the way you interview and share make them worth listening to and add a very special energy and, quotes, flavor. I'm very much interested in the work of C.G. Jung, and it is with great pleasure that I follow your explorations in that field. I have even taken the Jungian psychotherapy course with the Zur Institute to deepen my understanding, even though I don't work in the field of psychology or psychotherapy myself. Thank you again for your dedication and wonderful work, and should your path ever take you to Vienna, I will be more than happy to show you around, and it would be a great honor to meet you in person. All the best, and have a wonderful new year, Margaret." Thanks so much for that, Margaret. It's great to hear from you again. Margaret had offered to show me around Vienna when I was there. I think it's now 2 years ago or so that I was in Prague, but I didn't make it to Vienna as planned because other circumstances intervened. So that's still on my to-do list. Here's one from Barclay, another psychologist, and Barclay writes, "Dear David Van Nuys, as a fellow psychologist, also retired, I have to confess to more than a bit of podcast envy." I love that. "Your interviews and all of the extensive effort you expend to carry on your ambitious project are stellar examples of sustained creative endeavor at its most inspiring. With my own interests in adult development and lifelong learning, as well as in the convergence of psychological, neurological, and spiritual experience, I was thrilled to discover your podcast, quite by chance, through a generic internet search for stimulating audio related to psychology." Well, I'm glad to hear I popped up in that search. "Since that moment of serendipitous finding, during nearly 2 years now, I've been inwardly thanking you and appreciating you, while outwardly recommending you to others with great enthusiasm. Yay. I decided that you should wait no longer to know how much significant appreciation is flowing your way from one grateful listener. So here is a letter of gratitude to honor the deep spirit of thanksgiving when I began this overdue message to you. One delay in my contacting you has been the daunting number of things I've noticed and made mental notes about as I've listened to you, for I knew from the beginning I wanted to write and convey my enjoyment along with my admiration. It is a curious form of camaraderie to have learned so much about your process and your history and yet to have remained so totally unknown to you. I figure it's likely even that I must represent a certain percentage of your audience, hiding away in the comfort of anonymity while thoroughly enjoying your interviews. And I decided that it was finally time for me to act upon my good intentions." Yes, indeed. "I love the elegant simplicity of your basic idea, talking with interesting guests, and I marvel at the impressive heights and broad scopes to which you've taken that premise. The levels seem to keep multiplying, such as written transcripts, continuing education courses, wonderful photographs of your guests, and extensive biographical material, to name just a few, that represent originality with continuing follow-up and diligence on your part. Frequently, I will find myself re-listening to certain favorites. I enjoy the humor, the music, your perspective, your tone, your generosity, your inquiring mind at work, your nurturing of yet-to-be psychologists. I enjoy the way that your values as a person and as a psychologist shine through the interviews, and I find more to admire in the warmth of the relationships you cultivate with your listeners, whose devotion is so much in evidence in the emails you share. Often I feel literally exhilarated by the sheer volume of pleasure I experience from a single podcast, from the fun of your opening slogan and the Dylan-esque music to your reading of email in conclusion, which always sparks further thought. Thank you, David, for providing me with such mind-stirring inspiration in the context of such enjoyable accompaniment. It will be meaningful to count myself in the group who have made a connection with you. I look forward to continuing and to contributing. Gratefully, Barclay. And wow, such a tribute. And to receive that from a fellow retired psychologist. You know, when I started out to do this, I had no idea who would listen, how many people would listen, whether or not there would be any audience at all. And of course, there's always that fear lurking in the background that other psychologists will hate it and will somehow nail me to the wall for what, not being professional enough or, you know, some other imagined set of fears. So, of course, now in my seventh year, I no longer suffer from that fear because I've heard from professionals like Barclay, but I feel so seen and it's so rewarded by this communication. So thanks so much. So finally, I will touch on one more from Sergey in Australia, who writes in part, I was always interested in psychology, but that series of events sparked my interest even more. He's actually referring to the experience of transcendental transport while deep underneath the sea. He goes on to say, I listened to podcasts on my way to work. I started looking for podcasts on psychology I could listen to and discovered yours, and it exceeded all my expectations. I found much more than what I was looking for. Since then, I am your faithful listener. I enjoy very much the topics you raise and the way you conduct your interviews. Thank you, Dr. Dave. Actually, Sergey and I have had an exchange of emails in which I learned that he is, among other things, a beginning free diver, and as such, he has already learned to hold his breath for 3 minutes and dive without scuba gear to a depth of 30 meters. He's written eloquently about this and his trip to the Philippines to get trained in this, and he's got great photos too, and you'll find this on his blog at ozmoroz.com, and that's spelled OZMOROZ.com. I also discovered he has a second degree black belt in Aikido. I have such interesting and accomplished listeners. Okay, I think that better wrap it up for today. You can send your emails to shrink@shrinkwrapradio.com. And in addition to those, you can also leave comments about individual shows in the comments area on the site. You can leave voicemails on Skype, where I'm ShrinkPod, and you can leave voicemail on my message phone at 206-337-0622. You can also leave voicemails using our iPhone/Android app, about which you can find full details in the Apps tab on our site. Thanks to today's guest, Jungian analyst David Shane, for sharing his insights on the historical relationship between Jung and Alcoholics Anonymous, as well as a Jungian understanding of addiction. My next guest will be Dr. John Arden, who's the author of 12 books on consciousness and brain therapy, and will be discussing the convergence of different schools of psychotherapy in the light of recent neuroscience. So until next time, this is Dr. Dave saying, happy holidays, and they're all in your attitude.
You've been shrink-wrapped by Dr. Dave. All the psychology you need to know, and just enough to make you dangerous.